deep into the fabric of daily life. It had occurred quietly and largely out of easy view. At its core was a government campaign called Gleichschaltung, meaning coordination, to bring citizens, government ministries, universities, and cultural and social institutions in line with National Socialist beliefs and attitudes. Coordination occurred with astonishing speed, even in sectors of life not directly targeted by specific laws, as Germans willingly placed themselves under the sway of Nazi rule, a phenomenon that became known as Selbstgleichschaltung, or self-coordination. Change came to Germany so quickly and across such a wide front that German citizens who left the country for business or travel returned to find everything around them altered, as if they were characters in a horror movie who come back to find that people who once were their friends, clients, patients, and customers have become different in ways hard to discern. Gerda Laufer, a socialist, wrote that she felt deeply shaken that people whom one regarded as friends, who were known for a long time, from one hour to the next, transformed themselves. Neighbors turned surly. Petty jealousies flared into denunciations made to the SA, the stormtroopers, or to the newly founded Geheime Staatspolizei, only just becoming known by its acronym, Gestapo. Geheime Staatspolizei, coined by a post office clerk seeking a less cumbersome way of identifying the agency. The Gestapo's reputation for omniscience and malevolence arose from a confluence of two phenomena. First, a political climate in which merely criticizing the government could get one arrested, and second, the existence of a populace eager not just to step in line and become coordinated, but to also use Nazi sensitivities to satisfy individual needs and salve jealousies. One study of Nazi records found that of a sample of 213 denunciations, 37% arose not from heartfelt political belief, but from private conflicts, with the trigger often breathtakingly trivial. In October 1933, for example, the clerk at a grocery store turned in a cranky customer who had stubbornly insisted on receiving 3 pfennigs in change. The clerk accused her of failure to pay taxes. Germans denounced one another with such gusto that senior Nazi officials urged the populace to be more discriminating as to what circumstances might justify a report to the police. Hitler himself acknowledged, in a remark to his Minister of Justice, "We are living at present in a sea of denunciations and human meanness." A central element of coordination was the insertion into Germany's civil service law of the Aryan Clause, which effectively banned Jews from government jobs. Additional regulations and local animosities severely restricted Jews from practicing medicine and becoming lawyers. As onerous and dramatic as these restrictions were for Jews, they made little impression on tourists and other casual observers, partly because so few Jews lived in Germany. As of January 1933, only about 1% of Germany's 65 million people were Jewish, and most lived in major cities, leaving a negligible presence throughout the rest of the country. Nearly a third, just over 160,000, lived in Berlin alone. But they constituted less than 4% of the city's overall population of 4.2 million. And many lived in close-knit neighborhoods not typically included on visitors' itineraries. Yet even many Jewish residents failed to grasp the true meaning of what was occurring. 50,000 did see and left Germany within weeks of Hitler's ascension to Chancellor, but most stayed. Hardly anyone thought that the threats against the Jews were meant seriously, wrote Karl Zuckmayer, a Jewish writer. Even many Jews considered the savage anti-Semitic rantings of the Nazis merely a propaganda device, a line the Nazis would drop as soon as they won governmental power and were entrusted with public responsibilities. Although a song popular among stormtroopers bore the title, "When Jewish Blood Spurts from My Knife," by the time of the Dodds' arrival, violence against Jews had begun to wane. Incidents were sporadic, isolated. It was easy to be reassured, wrote historian John Dippel, in a study of why many Jews decided to stay in Germany. On the surface, much of daily life remained as it had been before Hitler came to power. Nazi attacks on the Jews were like summer thunderstorms that came and went quickly, leaving an eerie calm. The most visible marker of the coordination campaign was the sudden appearance of the Hitler salute, or Hitlergruß. It was sufficiently new to the outside world that Consul General Messerschmitt devoted an entire dispatch to the subject, dated August 8, 1933. The salute, he wrote, had no modern precedent, save for the more narrowly required salute of soldiers in the presence of superior officers. What made the practice unique was that everyone was expected to salute, even in the most mundane of encounters. Shopkeepers saluted customers. Children were required to salute their teachers several times a day. At the close of theatrical performances, a newly established custom demanded that audiences stand and salute as they sang first the German national anthem, Deutschland über alles, and second the stormtrooper anthem, the Horstfessellied, or Horstfessel Song, named for its composer, an SA thug killed by communists, but whom Nazi propaganda subsequently transformed into a hero. The German public had so avidly embraced the salute as to make the act of incessantly saluting almost comical, especially in the corridors of public buildings, where everyone from the lowliest messenger to the loftiest official saluted and hailed one another, turning a walk to the men's room into an exhausting affair. Messerschmitt refused to salute and merely stood at attention, but he understood that for ordinary Germans that would not have sufficed. At times even he felt real pressure to conform. At the close of a luncheon he attended in the port city of Kiel, all the guests stood and, with right arms extended, sang the national anthem and the Horstfessel song. Messerschmitt stood respectfully, as he would have in America, for the Star-Spangled Banner. Many of the other guests, including a number of stormtroopers, glared at him and whispered among themselves as if trying to divine his identity. I felt really quite fortunate that the incident took place within doors and among, on the whole, intelligent people, he wrote, for if it had been in a street gathering or in an outdoor demonstration, no questions would have been asked as to who I was, and that I would have been mishandled is almost unquestionable. Messerschmitt recommended that American visitors try to anticipate when the songs and salute would be required and leave early. He did not think it funny when now and then Ambassador Dodd threw him a mock salute. During her second week in Berlin, Martha discovered that she had not shed her past as completely as she had hoped. Bassett, her husband, arrived in the city on what he privately called his mission to Berlin, hoping to win Martha back. He checked in at the Hotel Adlon. They saw each other several times, but Bassett did not get the tear-filled rapprochement he had hoped for. Rather, he found a cordial indifference. "You remember our bicycle ride through the park?" he wrote later. "You were friendly, but I sensed a difference between us." To make matters worse, toward the end of his stay, Bassett caught a severe cold. It laid him flat, just in time for Martha's last visit before his departure. He knew that his mission to Berlin had failed the moment Martha arrived in his room. She had brought her brother Bill. It was a moment of casual cruelty. She knew Bassett would interpret it correctly. She was tired. She had loved him once, but their relationship had been too fraught with misunderstandings and conflicting imperatives. Where there had been love, as Martha later put it, there were now only embers, and these were not enough. Bassett understood. "You had had it," he wrote, "and who could blame you?" He sent her flowers, acknowledging defeat. The card that accompanied them began, "To my charming and lovely ex-wife." He left for America, for Larchmont, New York, and a suburban life of lawn mowing and tending the copper beech in his backyard, and evening drinks and potlucks, and a train commute to his job at the bank. He wrote later, I'm not at all sure you would have been happy as the wife of a bank economist, preoccupied with the bank letter, bringing up a family of children, PTA, and all that. Martha's connection with Sigrid Schultz soon began to pay off. Schultz threw a welcome party for Martha on July 23, 1933, and invited a number of her closest friends, among them still another correspondent, Quentin Reynolds, who wrote for the Hearst News Service. Martha and Reynolds hit it off instantly. He was big and cheerful, with curly hair and eyes that always seemed to convey a sense of impending laughter, though he had a reputation as well for being hard-nosed, skeptical, and smart. They met again 5 days later in the bar at the Esplanade, along with her brother Bill. Like Schultz, Reynolds knew everyone and had managed to befriend a number of Nazi officials, including a confidant of Hitler with the tongue-twisting name Ernst Franz Sedgwick Hanfstengel. A Harvard graduate with an American-born mother, Hanfstengel was known to play piano for Hitler late at night to soothe the dictator's nerves. No Mozart or Bach, mostly Wagner and Verdi, Liszt and Grieg, some Strauss and Chopin. Martha wanted to meet him. Reynolds knew of a party to be thrown by a fellow correspondent where Hanfstengel was expected to be a guest, and offered to bring her along. Chapter 7 Hidden Conflict. Dodd walked from the Esplanade to his office each morning, a 15-minute stroll along Tiergartenstrasse, the street that formed the southern boundary of the park. On the south side stood mansions with lush grounds and wrought-iron fences, many belonging to embassies and consulates. On the north sprawled the park itself, dense with trees and statuary, its paths inked with morning shade. Dodd called it the most beautiful park I have ever seen, and the walk quickly became his favorite part of the day. His office was in the embassy chancery on a street just off the park called Bendlerstrasse, which also contained the Bendler Block, a collection of squat, pale, rectangular buildings that served as the headquarters of the regular German army, the Reichswehr. A photograph of Dodd at work in his office during his first week or so in Berlin shows him seated at a large, elaborately carved desk before a soaring tapestry hung on the wall behind him, with a large and complicated phone to his left at a reach of maybe 5 feet. There is something comical about the image. Dodd, slight of frame, his collar stiff and white, hair pomaded and severely parted, stares with a stern expression into the camera, utterly dwarfed by the opulence that surrounds him. The photograph caused a good deal of mirth back at the State Department among those who disapproved of Dodd's appointment. Undersecretary Phillips closed a letter to Dodd. "A photograph of you seated at your desk in front of a gorgeous tapestry has had quite a wide circulation and looks most impressive." At every turn, Dodd seemed to violate some aspect of embassy custom, at least in the eyes of his counselor of embassy, George Gordon. Dodd insisted on walking to meetings with government officials. Once, in paying a call on the nearby Spanish embassy, he made Gordon walk with him, both men dressed in morning coats and silk hats. In a letter to Thornton Wilder evoking the scene, Martha wrote that Gordon had rolled in the gutter in an apoplectic fit. When Dodd drove anywhere, he took the family's Chevrolet, no match for the Opels and Mercedeses favored by senior Reich officials. He wore plain suits. He cracked wry jokes. On Monday, July 24th, he committed a particularly egregious sin. Consul General Messersmith had invited him and Gordon to a meeting with a visiting U.S. congressman to be held in Messersmith's office at the American Consulate, which occupied the first two floors of a building across the street from the Esplanade Hotel. Dodd arrived at Messersmith's office before Gordon. A few minutes later, the telephone rang. What Dodd gleaned from Messersmith's end of the conversation was that Gordon was now refusing to come. The reason? Pure pique. In Gordon's view, Dodd had degraded himself and his post by stooping to attend a meeting in the office of a man of inferior rank. Dodd observed in his diary, "Gordon is an industrious career man, with punctilio developed to the nth degree." Dodd could not immediately present his credentials, his letters of credence, to President Hindenburg, as demanded by diplomatic protocol, for Hindenburg was unwell and had retreated to his estate in Neudeck in East Prussia to convalesce. He was not expected to return until the end of the summer. Dodd, therefore, was not yet officially recognized as ambassador, and used this period of quiet to familiarize himself with such basic functions as the operation of the embassy phones, its telegraphic codes, and the typical departure times of diplomatic pouches. He met with a group of American correspondents, and then with some 20 German reporters, who, as Dodd feared, had seen the report in the Jewish Hamburger Israelitisches Familienblatt, claiming that he had come to Germany to rectify the wrongs to the Jews. Dodd read them what he described as a brief disavowal. He quickly got a taste of life in the new Germany. On his first full day in Berlin, Hitler's cabinet enacted a new law to take effect January 1, 1934, called the Law for the Prevention of Offspring with Hereditary Diseases, which authorized the sterilization of individuals suffering various physical and mental handicaps. He also learned that staff at the embassy and at Messerschmitt's consulate had become convinced that German authorities were intercepting incoming and outgoing mail, and that this had prompted Messerschmitt to take extraordinary measures to ensure that the most sensitive correspondence reached America unopened. The Consul General now dispatched messengers to hand such mail directly to the captains of ships bound for America, who would be met dockside by U.S. agents. One of the earliest tasks that Dodd assigned himself was to gain a grasp of the talents and deficits of the embassy's officers, known as first and second secretaries, and the various clerks, stenographers, and other employees who worked out of the chancery. From the start, Dodd found their work habits to be less than desirable. His more senior people came in each day at whatever hour seemed to please them, and periodically disappeared to hunt or play golf. Almost all, he found, were members of a golf club in the Wannsee district southwest of central Berlin. Many were independently wealthy, in keeping with the traditions of the Foreign Service, and spent money with abandon, their own and the embassy's. Dodd was particularly appalled at how much they spent on international cables. The messages were long and rambling, and thus needlessly expensive. In notes for a personnel report, he wrote brief descriptions of key people. He observed that Councillor Gordon's wife had a large income, and that Gordon tended to be temperamental. Emotional, too hostile to Germans, his irritations have been many and exasperating. In his sketch of one of the embassy's first secretaries, also wealthy, Dodd jotted the shorthand observation that he loves to pass upon the color of men's socks. Dodd noted that the woman who ran the embassy reception room, Julia Swope Lewin, was ill-suited to the task, as she was very anti-German, and this was not good for receiving German callers. Dodd also learned the contours of the political landscape beyond the embassy's walls. The world of Messerschmitt's dispatches now came alive outside his windows under the bright sky of a summer's day. There were banners everywhere, in a striking arrangement of colors, red background, white circle, and always a bold black broken cross, or Hakenkreuz, at the center. The word swastika was not yet the term of choice within the embassy. Dodd learned the significance of the various colors worn by the men he encountered during his walks. Brown uniforms, seemingly omnipresent, were worn by the stormtroopers of the SA. Black by a smaller, more elite force called the Schutzstaffel, or SS. Blue by the regular police. Dodd learned as well about the mounting power of the Gestapo and its young chief, Rudolf Diels. He was slender, dark, and considered handsome, despite an array of facial scars accumulated when, as a university student, he had engaged in the bare-blade dueling once practiced by young German men seeking to prove their manhood. Although his appearance was as sinister as that of a villain in a campy film, Diels had proved thus far, according to Messerschmitt, to be a man of integrity, helpful and rational, where his superiors, Hitler, Goering, and Goebbels, most decidedly were not. In many other ways as well, this new world was proving to be far more nuanced and complex than Dodd had expected. Deep fault lines ran through Hitler's government. Hitler had been chancellor since January 30, 1933, when he was appointed to the post by President Hindenburg as part of a deal crafted by senior conservative politicians who believed they could keep him under control, a notion that by the time of Dodd's arrival had been proved delusional. Hindenburg, known widely as the Old Gentleman, remained the last counterbalance to Hitler's power, and several days before Dodd's departure had made a public declaration of displeasure at Hitler's attempts to suppress the Protestant Church. Declaring himself an evangelical Christian, Hindenburg, in a published letter to Hitler, warned of growing anxiety for the inner freedom of the Church, and that if things continued as they had, the gravest damage must result to our people and fatherland, as well as injury to national unity. In addition to holding the constitutional authority to appoint a new chancellor, Hindenburg commanded the loyalty of the regular army, the Reichswehr. Hitler understood that if the nation began falling back into chaos, Hindenburg might feel compelled to replace the government and declare martial law. He also recognized that the most likely source of future instability was the SA, commanded by his friend and longtime ally, Captain Ernst Röhm. Increasingly, Hitler saw the SA as an undisciplined and radical force that had outlasted its purpose. Röhm thought otherwise. He and his stormtroopers had been pivotal in bringing about the National Socialist Revolution, and now, for their reward, wanted control of all the nation's military, including the Reichswehr. The army found this prospect loathsome. Fat, surly, admittedly homosexual and thoroughly dissipated, Röhm had none of the soldierly bearing the army revered. He did, however, command a fast-growing legion of over 1 million men. The regular army was only one-tenth the size, but far better trained and armed. The conflict simmered. Elsewhere in the government, Dodd thought he detected a new and decidedly moderate bent, at least by comparison to Hitler, Goering, and Goebbels, whom he described as adolescents in the great game of international leadership. It was in the next tier down, the ministries, that he found cause for hope. These men wished to stop all Jewish persecution, to cooperate with remnants of German liberalism, he wrote, and added, since the day of our arrival here, there has been a struggle between these groups. Dodd's assessment arose in large part from an early encounter with Germany's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Konstantin Freiherr von Neurath, whom Dodd, at least for now, perceived to be a member of the moderate camp. On Saturday, July 15th, Dodd paid a visit to Neurath at his ministry on Wilhelmstrasse, a boulevard that paralleled the eastern edge of the Tiergarten. So many key Reich offices lined the street that Wilhelmstrasse became a shorthand means of referring to the German government. Neurath was a handsome man, whose silver-gray hair, dark eyebrows, and close-trimmed gray mustache gave him the look of an actor who played fatherly roles. Martha would soon meet him as well and be struck by his ability to mask his interior emotions. His face, she wrote, was utterly expressionless, the proverbial poker face. Like Dodd, Neurath enjoyed taking walks and began each day with a stroll through the Tiergarten. Neurath saw himself as a sobering force in the government and believed he could help control Hitler and his party. As one peer put it, he was trying to train the Nazis and turn them into really serviceable partners in a moderate nationalist regime. But Neurath also thought it likely that Hitler's government eventually would do itself in. He always believed, one of his aides wrote, that if he would only stay in office, do his duty, and preserve foreign contacts, one fine day he would wake up and find the Nazis gone. Dodd thought him most agreeable, a judgment that affirmed Dodd's resolve to be as objective as possible about all that was occurring in Germany. Dodd assumed that Hitler must have other officials of the same caliber. In a letter to a friend, he wrote, "Hitler will fall into line with these wiser men and ease up on a tense situation." The very next day, at about 1:30 p.m. in Leipzig, the city where Dodd had gotten his doctorate, a young American by the name of Philip Zuckerman was taking a Sunday stroll with his German wife and her father and sister. Given that they were Jews, this was perhaps an imprudent thing to do on that particular weekend, when some 140,000 stormtroopers had flooded the town for one of the SA's frequent orgies of marching, drilling, and inevitably drinking. That Sunday afternoon, a massive parade began surging through the heart of the city under Nazi banners of red, white, and black that fluttered seemingly from every building. At 1:30, a company of these SA men broke off from the main formation and veered into an intersecting avenue, Nikolaistrasse, where the Zuckermans happened to be walking. As the SA detachment moved past, a group of men at the rear of the column decided the Zuckermans and kin had to be Jews, and without warning surrounded them, knocked them to the ground, and launched upon them a cyclone of furious kicks and punches. Eventually the stormtroopers moved on. Zuckerman and his wife were severely injured, enough so that both had to be hospitalized, first in Leipzig and then again in Berlin, where the U.S. consulate got involved. It is not unlikely that Zuckerman has suffered serious internal injuries from which he may never altogether recover, Consul General Messerschmitt wrote in a dispatch to Washington about the attack. He warned that the United States might be compelled to seek monetary damages for Zuckerman, but pointed out that nothing could be done officially on his wife's behalf because she was not an American. Messerschmitt added, "It is interesting to note that she was obliged, as the result of the attack made on her at the same time, to go to a hospital where her baby of some months had to be removed. As a result of the operation," he wrote, "Mrs. Zuckerman would never be able to bear another child." Attacks of this nature were supposed to have come to an end. Government decrees had urged restraint. The stormtroopers appeared not to have paid attention. In another dispatch on the case, Messerschmitt wrote, "It has been a favorite pastime of the SA men to attack the Jews, and one cannot avoid the plain language of stating that they do not like to be deprived of their prey." It was his insider's understanding of this and other phenomena of the New Germany that made him so frustrated with the failure of visitors to grasp the true character of Hitler's regime. Many American tourists returned home, perplexed by the dissonance between the horrors they had read about in their hometown newspapers, the beatings and arrests of the preceding spring, the book pyres and concentration camps, and the pleasant times they actually experienced while touring Germany. One such visitor was a radio commentator named H. V. Kaltenborn, born Hans von Kaltenborn in Milwaukee, who soon after Dodd's arrival passed through Berlin with his wife, daughter, and son. Known as the Dean of Commentators, Kaltenborn reported for the Columbia Broadcasting Service and had become famous throughout America, so famous that in later years he would have cameo roles as himself in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and the science fiction thriller The Day the Earth Stood Still. Before his departure for Germany, Kaltenborn had stopped in at the State Department and been allowed to read some of Consul General Messerschmitt's dispatches. At the time, he believed them to be exaggerated. Now, after 4 or 5 days in Berlin, he told Messerschmitt that he stood by his original conclusion and called the dispatches inaccurate and overdrawn. He suggested that Messerschmitt must have relied on faulty sources. Messerschmitt was shocked. He had no doubt that Kaltenborn was sincere, but attributed the commentator's view to the fact that he was a German by origin, and he couldn't believe that Germans could carry on and do things that were happening every day and every hour in Berlin and all over the country. It was a problem Messerschmitt had noticed time and again. Those who lived in Germany and who paid attention understood that something fundamental had changed, and that a darkness had settled over the landscape. Visitors failed to see it. In part, Messerschmitt wrote in a dispatch, this was because the German government had begun a campaign to influence Americans coming to Germany in forming a favorable opinion concerning happenings in the country. He saw evidence of this in the curious behavior of Samuel Bossard, an American attacked on August 31st by members of the Hitler Youth. Bossard had promptly filed an affidavit with the U.S. consulate and had spoken angrily about the incident to a number of correspondents in Berlin. Then, suddenly, he stopped speaking. Messerschmitt called him just before his return to America to ask how he was doing and found him unwilling to discuss the incident. Suspicious, Messerschmitt made inquiries and learned that the Ministry of Propaganda had toured Bossard through Berlin and Potsdam and otherwise showered him with courtesy and attention. The effort appeared to have paid off, Messerschmitt noted. Upon Bossard's arrival in New York, according to a news report, Bossard declared that if Americans in Germany are subject to any kind of attacks, it can only be due to misunderstanding. Many Americans do not seem to understand the changes which have taken place in Germany, and through their awkwardness have acted in such a way as to invite attacks. He vowed to return to Germany the following year. Messerschmitt sensed an especially deft hand behind the government's decision to cancel a ban on Rotary clubs in Germany. Not only could the clubs continue, more remarkably, they were allowed to retain their Jewish members. Messerschmitt himself belonged to the Berlin Rotary. The fact that Jews are permitted to continue membership in Rotary is being used as propaganda among the Rotary clubs throughout the world, he wrote. The underlying reality was that many of those Jewish members had lost their jobs or were finding their ability to practice within their professions severely limited. In his dispatches, Messerschmitt reprised one theme again and again, how impossible it was for casual visitors to understand what was really happening in this new Germany. The Americans coming to Germany will find themselves surrounded by influences of the government, and their time so taken up by pleasant entertainment that they will have little opportunity to learn what the real situation is. Messerschmitt urged Kaltenborn to get in touch with some of the American correspondents in Berlin, who would provide ample confirmation of his dispatches. Kaltenborn dismissed the idea. He knew a lot of these correspondents. They were prejudiced, he claimed, and so was Messerschmitt. He continued his journey, though in short order he would be forced, in a most compelling way, to reevaluate his views. Chapter 8 Meeting Putzi. With the help of Sigrid Schultz and Quentin Reynolds, Martha inserted herself readily into the social fabric of Berlin. Smart, flirtatious, and good-looking, she became a favorite among the younger officers of the Foreign Diplomatic Corps and a sought-after guest at the informal parties, the so-called bean parties and beer evenings, held after the obligatory functions of the day had concluded. She also became a regular at a nightly gathering of 20 or so correspondents who convened in an Italian restaurant, Die Taverne, owned by a German and his Belgian wife. The restaurant always set aside a big round table in a corner for the group, a Stammtisch, meaning a table for regulars, whose members, including Schultz, typically began to arrive at about 10 in the evening and might linger until as late as 4 the next morning. The group had achieved a kind of fame. Everybody else in the restaurant is watching them and trying to overhear what they are saying, wrote Christopher Isherwood in Goodbye to Berlin. If you have a piece of news to bring them, the details of an arrest, or the address of a victim whose relatives might be interviewed, then one of the journalists leaves the table and walks up and down with you outside in the street. The table often drew cameo visits from the first and second secretaries of foreign embassies and various Nazi press officials, and on occasion even Gestapo chief Rudolf Diels. William Shirer, a later member of the group, saw Martha as a worthy participant. Pretty, vivacious, a mighty arguer. In this new world, the calling card was the crucial currency. The character of an individual's card reflected the character of the individual, his perception of himself, or how he wanted the world to perceive him. The Nazi leadership invariably had the largest cards with the most imposing titles, usually printed in some bold Teutonic font. Prince Louis Ferdinand, son of Germany's crown prince, a sweet-tempered young man who had worked in a Ford assembly plant in America, had the tiniest of cards, with only his name and title. His father, on the other hand, had a large card with a photograph of himself on one side in full princely regalia, the other side blank. Cards were versatile. Notes scrawled on cards served as invitations to dinner or cocktails or more compelling assignations. By simply crossing out the last name, a man or woman conveyed friendship, interest, even intimacy. Martha accumulated dozens of cards and saved them. Cards from Prince Louis, soon to become a suitor and friend, from Sigrid Schultz, of course, and from Mildred Fish Harnack, who had been present on the station platform when Martha and her parents arrived in Berlin. A correspondent for the United Press, Webb Miller, wrote on his card, "If you have nothing more important to do, why not have dinner with me?" He provided his hotel and room number. At last she met her first senior Nazi. As promised, Reynolds took her to the party of his English friend, a lavish and fairly drunken affair. Well, after their arrival, an immense man with a brick of coal-black hair slammed into the room in a sensational manner, Martha later recalled, passing his card left and right with a decided emphasis on recipients who were young and pretty. At 6 feet 4 inches in height, he was a head taller than most men in the room and weighed easily 250 pounds. A female observer once described him as supremely awkward-looking, an enormous puppet on slack strings. Even amid the din of the party, his voice stood out like thunder over rain. This, Reynolds told Martha, was Ernst Hanfstengel. Officially, as stated on his card, he was Auslandspressechef, foreign press chief of the National Socialist Party, though in fact this was largely a made-up job with little real authority, a sop granted by Hitler to acknowledge Hanfstengel's friendship ever since the early days, when Hitler often came to Hanfstengel's home. Upon being introduced, Hanfstengel told Martha, "Call me Putzi." It was his childhood nickname, used universally by his friends and acquaintances and by all the city's correspondents. This was the giant that Martha by now had heard so much about. He of the unpronounceable, unspellable last name, adored by many correspondents and diplomats, loathed and distrusted by many others, this latter camp including George Messerschmitt, who claimed an instinctive dislike for the man. "He is totally insincere, and one cannot believe a word he says," Messerschmitt wrote. "He pretends the closest friendship with those whom he is at the same time trying to undermine or whom he may be directly attacking." Martha's friend Reynolds at first liked Hanfstengel. In contrast with other Nazis, the man went out of his way to be cordial to Americans, Reynolds recalled. Hanfstengel offered to arrange interviews that otherwise might be impossible to get, and sought to present himself to the city's correspondents as one of the boys, informal, hail fellow, well-met, charming. Reynolds's affection for Hanfstengel eventually cooled, however. "You had to know Putzi to really dislike him. That," he noted, "came later." Hanfstengel spoke English beautifully. At Harvard he had been a member of the Hasty Pudding Club, a theatrical group, and forever bent the minds of his audience when for one performance he dressed as a Dutch girl named Gretchen Spoetspfeifer. He had come to know classmate Theodore Roosevelt Jr., eldest son of Teddy Roosevelt, and had become a regular visitor to the White House. One story held that Humpstengel had played a piano in the White House basement with such verve that he broke 7 strings. As an adult, he had run his family's art gallery in New York, where he had met his wife-to-be. After moving to Germany, the couple had grown close to Hitler and had made him godfather of their newborn son, Egon. The boy called him Uncle Dolph. Sometimes when Humpstengel played for Hitler, the dictator wept. Martha liked Humpstengel. He was not at all what she expected a senior Nazi official to be, so blatantly proclaiming his charm and talent. He was big and full of energy, with giant, long-fingered hands, hands that Martha's friend Bella Fromm would describe as being of almost frightening dimensions, and a personality that bounded readily from one extreme to another. Martha wrote, "He had a soft, ingratiating manner, a beautiful voice which he used with conscious artistry, sometimes whispering low and soft, the next minute bellowing and shattering the room. He dominated any social milieu. He could exhaust anyone, and from sheer perseverance outshout or outwhisper the strongest man in Berlin." Humpstengel took a liking to Martha as well, but did not think much of her father. He was a modest little Southern history professor who ran his embassy on a shoestring and was probably trying to save money out of his pay, Humpstengel wrote in a memoir. At a time when it needed a robust millionaire to compete with the flamboyance of the Nazis, he teetered round self-effacingly as if he were still on his college campus. Humpstengel dismissively referred to him as Papa Dodd. The best thing about Dodd, Humpstengel wrote, was his attractive blonde daughter Martha, whom I got to know very well. Humpstengel found her charming, vibrant, and clearly a woman of sexual appetite, which gave him an idea. Chapter 9. Death is Death. Dodd sought to maintain his objective stance, despite early encounters with visitors who had experienced a Germany very different from the cheery, sun-dappled realm he walked through each morning. One such visitor was Edgar A. Maurer, at the time the most famous correspondent in Berlin and the center of a maelstrom of controversy. In addition to reporting for the Chicago Daily News, Maurer had written a best-selling book, Germany Puts the Clock Back, which had angered Nazi officials to the point where Maurer's friends believed he faced mortal danger. Hitler's government wanted him out of the country. Maurer wanted to stay, and came to Dodd to ask him to intercede. Maurer had long been a target of Nazi ire. In his dispatches from Germany, he had managed to cut below the patina of normalcy to capture events that challenged belief, and he used novel reporting techniques to do it. One of his foremost sources of information was his doctor, a Jew who was the son of the Grand Rabbi of Berlin. Every 2 weeks or so, Maurer would make an appointment to see him, ostensibly for a persistent throat complaint. Each time, the doctor would give him a typed report of the latest Nazi excesses, a method that worked until the doctor came to suspect that Maurer was being followed. The two arranged a new rendezvous point. Every Wednesday at 11:45 a.m., they met in the public restroom underneath Potsdamer Platz. They stood at adjacent urinals. The doctor would drop the latest report, and Maurer would pick it up. Putzi Humpstengel tried to undermine Maurer's credibility by spreading a false rumor that the reason his reports were so aggressively critical was that he was a secret Jew. In fact, the same thought had occurred to Martha. "I was inclined to think him Jewish," she wrote. She considered his animus to be prompted only by his racial self-consciousness. Maurer was appalled at the failure of the outside world to grasp what was really happening in Germany. He found that even his own brother had come to doubt the truth of his reports. Maurer invited Dodd to dinner at his apartment overlooking the Tiergarten and tried to clue him in to certain hidden realities. To no purpose, Maurer wrote. He knew better. Even the periodic assaults against Americans appeared not to have moved the ambassador, Maurer recalled. Dodd announced he had no wish to mix in Germany's affairs. Dodd, for his part, assessed Maurer as being almost as vehement in his way as the Nazis. Threats against Maurer increased. Within the Nazi hierarchy, there was talk of inflicting physical harm on the correspondent. Gestapo chief Rudolf Diels felt compelled to warn the U.S. Embassy that Hitler became enraged whenever Maurer's name was mentioned. Diels worried that some fanatic might kill Maurer or otherwise eliminate him from the picture, and claimed to have assigned certain Gestapo men of responsibility to stand discreet watch over the correspondent and his family. When Maurer's boss, Frank Knox, owner of the Chicago Daily News, learned of these threats, he resolved to transfer Maurer out of Berlin. He offered him the paper's bureau in Tokyo. Maurer accepted grudgingly, aware that sooner or later he would be expelled from Germany, but he insisted on staying until October, partly just to demonstrate that he would not bow to intimidation, but mainly because he wanted to cover the annual Nazi Party spectacle in Nuremberg, set to begin September 1st. This next rally, the Party Day of Victory, promised to be the biggest yet. The Nazis wanted him gone immediately. Stormtroopers appeared outside his office. They followed his friends and made threats against his bureau staff. In Washington, Germany's ambassador to the United States notified the State Department that because of the people's righteous indignation, the government could no longer hope to keep Maurer free from harm. At this point, even his fellow correspondents became concerned. H.R. Knickerbocker and another reporter went to see Consul General Messerschmitt to ask him to persuade Maurer to leave. Messerschmitt was reluctant. He knew Maurer well and respected his courage in facing down Nazi threats. He feared that Maurer might view his intercession as a betrayal. Nonetheless, he agreed to try. "It was one of the most difficult conversations I ever had," Messerschmitt wrote later. When he saw that I was joining his other friends in trying to persuade him to leave, tears came into his eyes, and he looked at me reproachfully. Nonetheless, Messerschmitt felt it was his duty to convince Maurer to leave. Maurer gave up with a gesture of despair and left Messerschmitt's office. Now Maurer took his case directly to Ambassador Dodd, but Dodd too believed he should leave, not just for his safety, but because his reporting imparted an extra layer of strain to what was already a very challenging diplomatic environment. Dodd told him, "If you were not being moved by your paper anyway, I would go to the mat on this issue. Won't you do this to avoid complications?" Maurer gave in. He agreed to leave on September 1st, the first full day of the Nuremberg rally he so wanted to cover. Martha wrote later that Maurer never quite forgave my father for this advice. Another of Dodd's early visitors was, as Dodd wrote, perhaps the foremost chemist in Germany. But he did not look it. He was smallish in size and egg-bald, with a narrow gray mustache above full lips. His complexion was sallow, his air that of a much older man. He was Fritz Haber. To any German, the name was well known and revered, or had been until the advent of Hitler. Until recently, Haber had been director of the famed Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physical Chemistry. He was a war hero and a Nobel laureate. Hoping to break the stalemate in the trenches during the Great War, Haber had invented poison chlorine gas. He had devised what became known as Haber's rule, a formula, C times T equals K, elegant in its lethality. A low exposure to gas over a long period will have the same result as a high exposure over a short period. He also invented a means to distribute his poison gas at the front, and was himself present in 1915 for its first use against French forces at Ypres. On a personal level, that day at Ypres cost him dearly. His wife of 32 years, Clara, had long condemned his work as inhumane and immoral and demanded he stop. But to such concerns he gave a stock reply, "Death was death, no matter the cause." 9 days after the gas attack at Ypres, she committed suicide. Despite international outcry over his poison gas research, Haber was awarded the 1918 Nobel Prize for Chemistry for discovering a means of mining nitrogen from air and thus allowing the manufacture of plentiful cheap fertilizer. And, of course, gunpowder. Despite a pre-war conversion to Protestantism, Haber was classified under the new Nazi laws as non-Aryan, but an exception granted to Jewish war veterans allowed him to remain director of the Institute. Many Jewish scientists on his staff did not qualify for the exemption, however, and on April 21, 1933, Haber was ordered to dismiss them. He fought the decision, but found few allies. Even his friend Max Planck offered tepid consolation. In this profound dejection, Planck wrote, "My sole solace is that we live in a time of catastrophe such as attends every revolution, and that we must endure much of what happens as a phenomenon of nature, without agonizing over whether things could have turned out differently." Haber didn't see it that way. Rather than preside over the dismissal of his friends and colleagues, he resigned. Now, Friday, July 28, 1933, with few choices remaining, he came to Dodd's office for help, bearing a letter from Henry Morgenthau, Jr., head of Roosevelt's Federal Farm Board and future Treasury Secretary. Morgenthau was Jewish and an advocate for Jewish refugees. As Haber told his story, he trembled from head to foot, Dodd wrote in his diary, calling Haber's account "the saddest story of Jewish persecution I have yet heard." Haber was 65 years old, with a failing heart, and was now being denied the pension that had been guaranteed him under the laws of the Weimar Republic, which immediately preceded Hitler's Third Reich. He wished to know the possibilities in America for emigrants with distinguished records here in science, Dodd wrote. "I could only say that the law allowed none now, the quota being filled." Dodd promised to write to the Labor Department, which administered immigration quotas, to ask if any favorable ruling might be made for such people. They shook hands. Haber warned Dodd to be careful about talking of his case to others, as the consequences might be bad. And then Haber left. A small, gray chemist, who had once been one of Germany's most important scientific assets. "Poor old man," Dodd recalled thinking, then caught himself, for Haber was in fact only 1 year older than he was. "Such treatment," Dodd wrote in his diary, "can only bring evil to the government which practices such terrible cruelty." Dodd discovered, too late, that what he had told Haber was simply incorrect. The next week, on August 5th, Dodd wrote to Isidore Lubin, chief of the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, "You know the quota is already full, and you probably realize that a large number of very excellent people would like to migrate to the United States, even though they have to sacrifice their property in doing so." In light of this, Dodd wanted to know whether the Labor Department had discovered any means through which the most deserving of these people can be admitted. Lubin forwarded Dodd's letter to Colonel D.W. McCormick, Commissioner of Immigration and Naturalization, who on August 23rd wrote back to Lubin and told him, "The ambassador appears to have been misinformed in this connection. In fact, only a small fraction of the visas allotted under the German quota had been issued, and the fault, McCormick made clear, lay with the State Department and Foreign Service, and their enthusiastic enforcement of the clause that barred entry to people likely to become a public charge. Nothing in Dodd's papers explains how he came to believe the quota was full." All this came too late for Haber. He left for England to teach at Cambridge University, a seemingly happy resolution, but he found himself adrift in an alien culture, torn from his past, and suffering the effects of an inhospitable climate. Within 6 months of leaving Dodd's office, during a convalescence in Switzerland, he suffered a fatal heart attack, his passing unlamented in the new Germany. Within a decade, however, the Third Reich would find a new use for Haber's rule, and for an insecticide that Haber had invented at his institute, composed in part of cyanide gas and typically deployed to fumigate structures used for the storage of grain. At first called Zyklon A, it would be transformed by German chemists into a more lethal variant, Zyklon B. Despite this encounter, Dodd remained convinced that the government was growing more moderate and that Nazi mistreatment of Jews was on the wane. He said as much in a letter to Rabbi Wise of the American Jewish Congress, whom he had met at the Century Club in New York and who had been a fellow passenger on his ship to Germany. Rabbi Wise was startled. In a July 28th reply from Geneva, he wrote, "How I wish I could share your optimism. I must, however, tell you that everything, every word from scores of refugees in London and Paris within the last 2 weeks leads me to feel that far from there having been, as you believe, an improvement, things are becoming graver and more oppressive for German Jews from day to day. I am certain that my impression would be borne out by the men whom you met at the little conference at the Century Club." He was reminding Dodd of the meeting in New York that had been attended by Wise, Felix Warburg, and other Jewish leaders. Privately, in a letter to his daughter, Wise wrote that Dodd is being lied to. Dodd stood by his view. In a response to Wise's letter, Dodd countered that "the many sources of information open to the office here seem to me to indicate a desire to ease up on the Jewish problem. Of course, many incidents of very disagreeable character continue to be reported. These, I think, are the hangovers from the earlier agitation. While I am in no sense disposed to excuse or apologize for such conditions, I am quite convinced that the leading element in the government inclines to a milder policy as soon as possible." He added, "Of course you know our government cannot intervene in such domestic matters. All one can do is to present the American point of view and stress the unhappy consequences of such a policy as has been pursued." He told Wise he opposed open protest. "It is my judgment that the greatest influence we can exercise on behalf of a more kindly and humane policy is to be applied unofficially and through private conversations with men who already begin to see the risks involved." Wise was so concerned about Dodd's apparent failure to grasp what was really occurring that he offered to come to Berlin and, as he told his own daughter, Justine, tell him the truth, which he would not otherwise hear. At the time, Wise was traveling in Switzerland. From Zurich, he again begged Dodd by telephone to make possible my air flight to Berlin. Dodd refused. Wise was too well known in Germany and too widely hated. His photograph had appeared in the Volkischer Beobachter and Die Stürmer too often. As Wise recounted in a memoir, "Dodd feared I might be recognized, particularly because of my unmistakable passport, and give rise to an unpleasant incident at a landing place such as Nuremberg." The ambassador was unswayed by Wise's suggestion that an embassy official meet him at the airport and keep him in sight for the duration of his trip. While in Switzerland, Wise attended the World Jewish Conference in Geneva, where he introduced a resolution that called for a world boycott of German commerce. The resolution passed. Wise would have been heartened to learn that Consul General Messerschmitt held a much darker view of events than Dodd. While Messerschmitt agreed that incidents of outright violence against Jews had fallen off sharply, he saw that these had been superseded by a form of persecution that was far more insidious and pervasive. In a dispatch to the State Department, he wrote, "Briefly, it may be said that the situation of the Jews in every respect except that of personal safety is constantly growing more difficult, and that the restrictions in effect are becoming daily more effective in practice, and that new restrictions are constantly appearing." He cited several new developments. Jewish dentists were now barred from taking care of patients under Germany's social insurance system, an echo of what had happened to Jewish doctors earlier in the year. A new German fashion office had just excluded Jewish dressmakers from participating in an upcoming fashion show. Jews and anyone who had even the appearance of a non-Aryan were forbidden to become policemen. and Jews, Messerschmitt reported, were now officially banned from the bathing beach at Wannsee. Even more systemic persecution was on the way, Messerschmitt wrote. He had learned that a draft existed of a new law that would effectively deprive Jews of their citizenship and all civil rights. Germany's Jews, he wrote, look upon this proposed law as the most serious moral blow which could be delivered to them. They have and are